Great. Well, thank you, everyone. I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this closing general session. It's KI, and there may be some materials on them on the chairs. And also, if you're interested in contacting them, I think there's some contact information on the back of the program. So without any further ado, I want to introduce our closing speaker today. It's Steve Mintz, who comes to us from the University of Texas System from Columbia University, where he was a professor of history and director of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences Teaching Center. He's a former fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, he was. And he also taught at Oberlin College, the University of Houston, Harvard's University Extension School, Pepperdine, and the University of GH and Siegen. A leading authority on the history of families and children, he is the author and editor of 13 books, including Huck's Raft, A History of American Childhood, which received major prizes from the Association of American Publishers, the Organization of American Historians, and the Texas Institute of Letters. He's also received, also served as president of the Society for the History of Children and Youth, and chaired the Council on Contemporary Families, an organization of leading academics and clinicians committed to improving the public conversation on families and their needs. He has also chaired the Bancroft Prize and Frederick Douglass Book Prize juries and received over $12 million in external funding, including two National Endowment for the Humanities Challenge grants. He frequently appears on public radio and in the New York Times, USA Today, and the Washington Post. It's my great pleasure to give you now Steve Mintz. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Every day is bringing signs that we have reached a tipping point in the transformation of higher education. If you read the Chronicle of Higher Education or Inside Higher Ed this morning, you would have read four stories that I think are quite shocking and wouldn't have seemed believable even 5 years ago. The governor of my state had called for a $10,000 degree, and now the first of those $10,000 degrees are appearing. The first one's in organizational management leadership, and it's a competency-based, personalized, adaptive degree pathway. The Educational Testing Service announced that it will be offering assessments and badges to allow undergraduates to prove to employers that they have certain competencies. I always had thought of ETS as part of the higher ed establishment, but now ETS is clearly seeing an independent role in evaluating student learning. So we're beginning to see the first movement to alternative modes of accreditation that are outside the purview of our own universities. There was a story about a divorce between Pearson and Howard University. They had announced a plan for a massive online educational endeavor, and that has broken down due to faculty resistance. And then there was another story about how the number of faculty members at universities continues to decline even as support staff increases. Okay, a lot of changes are going on. And these are, of course, only the tips of the iceberg. You may be familiar, just last week, MIT announced that it's going to unbundle all of its courses, transform all of them into modules, and then license the modules. Or Harvard's going to develop a three-pronged approach to online learning. There'll be free MOOCs, verified certificates for $350, and then full credit through Harvard Extension for $2,050. So you'll be able to get something that looks like a Harvard degree, right, online. The world is changing quickly, and of course, we're all familiar with Georgia Tech's $6,700 top 10 computer science master's degree. The world is shifting. Since 1973, the U.S. economy has gone through a series of waves of disruption. The first wave disrupted manufacturing. A series of lumbering dinosaurs were overturned virtually overnight. Steel, machine tools, autos. The United States lost 40 million manufacturing jobs during the 1970s. But that just seemed like it was Detroit's problem or Youngstown's problem. Then the second wave disrupted the music industry and the publishing industry and journalism. Even the New York Times has gone from approximately 2,000 journalists to fewer than 1,000. The third wave struck retailing as Amazon and other online providers of retail goods devastated the big box stores. And the fourth wave right now is striking higher education. Disruptions start small. There's a publisher like Elsevier, and universities give their intellectual property to a small publishing company because it seems cheaper than running their own journals. And then a small for-profit, University of Phoenix, enters the picture. And it just seems like it's on the margins. And then a small but agile nonprofit, like Southern New Hampshire University, enters the picture. Soon, these begin to eat universities' lunch. Higher education is on the crest of a vast transformation, and it will occur far more quickly than most anticipate. I'm a historian. I'm usually much better at predicting the past than the future. I can tell you who won World War II, and it's awfully hard to see into the distance. However, I was given $50 million by the Regents and told to make some dramatic changes, so I think I can speak with some authority that change is going to come quickly. And so what I'd like to do is talk about how higher ed will be different in 24 months. Not in some distant future when we have cold fusion, but right now, okay, right around the corner. You know, one of the most obvious changes is that students are going to have access to open source, open access textbooks. Right now, the average student's paying about $500 to $1,000 a year just on textbook costs. And there is huge pressure to make that change, and I can assure you it will change. As university systems across the country develop repositories of learning objects and open source books and encourage our faculty to make use of these resources instead of traditional resources. And of course, those open source learning objects will include simulations and animations, online laboratories, serious games, immersive learning environments. It won't be simply textbooks per usual. Another change will be a shift away from the fixed calendar that we're all familiar with, as if the 15-week semester had been written in the Ten Commandments. The uniform start date, the 15-week semester, these are going to decline as an increasing emphasis is placed on competencies and proficiencies rather than seat time. Oh. More online courses are going to be available for free, and whether they'll be consumed separately or integrated into hybrid classes remains to be seen. But they will be out there, and they will be setting a bar for what we think of as quality. Large lecture classes, these probably are on the brink of extinction. They'll be replaced by alternate modes of delivery, accelerated classes, web-enhanced courses, fully online courses, competency-based modules, Emporium-supplemented courses, machine learning. All of these options are going to proliferate. And then there are new kinds of credentials. Right now, there is nothing except an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And if you don't get one of those, all you get is debt, right? And we're going to be moving very swiftly to a system where there'll be all kinds of other assessments, other credentials. They'll have all kinds of names, badges, certificates, specializations, and the like. And that's not far distant. It is just over the horizon. And of course, here at EDUCAUSE, we've heard of other innovations that will be taking place very swiftly. E-advising and fine-grained analytics in Texas, the average student who gets an associate's degree takes 120 credit hours. And the average student who gets a BA takes over 150 credit hours. Remember, you only need 60 hours for an associate's degree and only 120 for a bachelor's degree. We can't live with this. I mean, that's an extra year or more automatically, and usually it's a couple more years. So we're going to have intrusive advising systems that are going to warn us instantly about at-risk students, and then we are going to go in full force to get them on track. Okay. Personalized adaptive pedagogies have always been a dream, but you're going to see the real thing within the next 2 years. These will be courses with built-in remediation, but also built-in enrichment. And they will be designed from the get-go to make sure every student can succeed. When I taught in Houston for 20 years, I had 40,000 students in face-to-face classes. When you teach 592 at a time, they add up quickly. Even though I was teaching the easiest course on the face of the earth, Intro to U.S. History, which students had had in 5th grade, 8th grade, and 11th grade, 30% of my students got a D, F, or W. Come on, right? I mean, what could be easier? People should be able to ace that. Clearly, there were serious problems, and we need to go to a new mode. And that history class is typical, unfortunately, of what is going on across the higher educational landscape, where we have pinch point and bottleneck courses that are inhibiting students from graduating, and we've got to do something about that. Social learning, where online learning will have powerful social dimensions, these will be another dimension of next generation learning, not in the distant future, but within the next 2 years. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the forces that are driving these changes. I'm sure you're all more or less familiar with these forces, but I think it's worthwhile stepping back for one moment and just running through them. The first problem is financial. Now, the obvious causes are an inability to increase tuition at the rate we've increased it in the past. Between 1979 and 2010, tuition increased at the inflation rate plus 4% every year. That was not sustainable. It is over. Okay? But that means institutions have a serious problem. Because the other sources of revenue, state appropriations, federal grants, philanthropy, are also stagnating. But there's a deeper problem that many institutions face. Our institutions run on a system of cross subsidies. My big U.S. history class paid for those upper division seminars. And those days are done. Okay, at the University of Texas at Austin, in my department, history enrollment has gone down 50% in 5 years. It's not that the teaching got worse. It's not that students went into business. They consumed education differently. They took early college dual degree courses. They took AP courses. They took history at community college. And they went to a variety of online providers. You reduce enrollments in the large lecture classes by 50%, and then you see how your business model functions. And I can assure you, it doesn't function. Football cannot make up for those kind of losses. Okay? So one problem is financial. The second is demographic. One of the greatest achievements of higher education in the last 15 years has been the democratization of higher ed. Remember, UT Austin has more Pell Grant students, that is, students from the bottom 50% of the income distribution, than the entire Ivy League plus Stanford and Chicago put together. Right? So we have a growing number of non-traditional students, students who are full-time workers, commuters, parents and caregivers, English language learners, and the like, and we're not doing a good job of graduating these students. And this is both politically unacceptable and morally intolerable. For higher ed as a whole, the graduation rate at the post-secondary level is a little over 50%. And for non-traditional students, it's much, much less. We're talking in the area of 30%. And we have to do something about that. We have an incredibly leaky educational pipeline. In Texas, one eighth grader in five will ever receive a post-secondary credential of any kind. And that's true across this country. Furthermore, students, as I suggested, are consuming education from multiple institutions, just like Sarah Palin, right? And yet this also creates havoc because we don't have good articulation agreements that allow institutions to accept credit. Then there's a career challenge. Colleges do a very poor job of helping most students identify career objectives and a realistic path towards that career. And the result of all this is a political or ideological problem. The overwhelming majority of adults in this country do not believe that higher education provides a good value for the money. And the overwhelming majority of employers do not believe that our institutions prepare our students well for their jobs. We may yell and scream all we wish, but the fact is that those are deeply entrenched attitudes, and they are a reality that shapes our future. Given these challenges, universities must race to introduce transformative models, transformative certification models, transformative delivery models, transformative business models, transformative pedagogies. And in doing this, we have a great deal to learn from the for-profits. And we may think that they exist in one world and we exist in another. We now exist in the same world. And there's much we have to learn from them. The first thing we need to learn from them is that there are huge untapped markets. These consist of students who never went to college or who are poorly served by college. At most public flagship universities, 30% of the students never get a degree. In Texas, to get to the flagship university, you have to be the top 7% of your graduating course in class in high school. In other words, you're completely equipped to get a degree. We're serving those students poorly. We've got to serve them better. In Texas, we have 3.6 million students who went to college and never got a degree. We need to do something about that. And that's true proportionately in every state. The genius of the for-profits was to target those unserved and poorly served students. We've got to do the same. Second, we've got to, as I would put it, process analyze the student life cycle. Where do things go wrong? And why do they go wrong? And then we need to re-engineer the process to ensure that students are successful. That's what the for-profits do. We need to do the same. Third, we have to move to a new student support and staffing model, which is scary but necessary. Students are going to need more coaching, more tutoring, and more support. What exactly that coaching model will look like is being decided right now. Will we be using peer mentors? Will we be using full-time coaches? We're going to be using something because we've got to make student support available 24/7. And it needs to be not only anytime, anywhere, on any device. But it needs to be holistic. The days of saying, well, you have this problem and you go to that office, and you have this problem and you go to this office, those are going to have to end. And so we're going to have to figure out how to deliver student support services in this new environment. We're going to have to recognize the value of scale. At many of our universities, upwards of 500 courses meet the general education requirements. These courses are of widely varying quality. Most of the faculty who teach them hate to teach those courses. Many students fail during this first and second year transition to college. It's not an economically efficient model, but it's also not a very effective model. And we're going to have to figure out how we could scale certain courses to make them more effective. As you probably know, Candace Till, previously of OLI and now at Stanford, spent $1 million per course to develop personalized adaptive gateway courses. These are extraordinarily expensive endeavors. And so there's going to be a lot of opportunity for cross-institutional, cross-system, cross-state cooperation in developing these kinds of courses to make sure that they're really effective. And finally, what the for-profits realized that we didn't is that students need a clear value proposition. Most students who drop out do not drop out because they didn't have the preparedness for college. They dropped out of college because they didn't see the point. The value proposition was not obvious to them. And we've got to think about how we can make it clearer to them. So let's talk about the transformations that need to take place and that will take place in the next 2 years. First, transformational program designs. Much of the work that we do on our campuses is at the individual course level. But I just want to suggest to you that is the wrong strategy. Because a professor who's enthusiastic one day is unenthusiastic the next, or leaves or dies, and all that expenditure was for naught. There's no buy-in in the department, there's no buy-in in the college, and all that effort that we put in was wasted. So we have to think much more at the program level than at the course level. And these new programs, I think, which I'll call verticals as opposed to majors, will be streamlined with aligned readings and aligned assignments. They will be industry-oriented. They will be optimized to promote, to accelerate time to degree. They will be competency-driven. They will be outcomes-driven. They won't replace your standard biology major or physics major or history major, but I am convinced that over time, these kind of industry-driven, competency-based verticals will come to define much of higher ed. Transformational pedagogies. This is what EDUCAUSE is all about, of course, where we move from students as recipients of knowledge to students as creators of knowledge. Students engaged in all kinds of active endeavors, freshman research projects, for example, or authentic real-world problem-solving and the like. Instructional design informed by the science of learning with clearly defined learning objectives and activities and assessments aligned with learning goals. To all of us, this is just common sense. To many faculty members, this is from Mars. So teaching will become more outcomes-focused, more interactive, more developmental, more success-oriented. Transformational delivery modes. And what I mean by this are briefer courses, 6 to 8 weeks in length, low residency programs, competency-based modules. There's going to be a whole assortment of new delivery modes that are going to become widespread, not in the distant future, but soon. We've already mentioned transformational certification models, badges, certificates, specializations, and the like. And then there are transformational business models. When you lose 50% of your enrollment in your introductory classes, how do you support your institution? When you have a vast influx of low-income, non-traditional students into your institution, how does the business model work? At several of the campuses that I oversee, the net tuition after financial aid, but including state funding, is $2,500 per student. How do you support an institution of the kind you and I take for granted with that kind of revenue? Not easily. But let me emphasize, this is as true at elite, well-endowed institutions as at low-cost publics. Columbia University, where I taught, has the highest tuition in the United States, $60,000 a year. Okay? And you would think that should be plenty to run an institution, an endowment of $8 billion, right? It just completed a fundraising campaign of over $6 billion, the second most ever raised by a university. So how could Columbia have problems? One quarter of the undergraduate student body is now international students because they don't get financial aid. Just as 25% of the students at Berkeley are out of state because they don't get financial aid. Even, in other words, well-endowed, well-financed, elite institutions that have huge research operations bringing in external funding, they have problems too. And so it's going to be essential that campuses identify new revenue streams. Now, the most obvious one is online learning. Right now, a little over 100 universities have really extensive online programs that are targeted at students other than matriculated students. And the best estimate is that in 3 years, it's going to be 500 universities. At the very time that online enrollment is stagnating. In other words, you're going to have tremendous competition for pretty much a fixed pool of students. Now, some institutions like MIT and Harvard are going to go very aggressively after the international market. Just last week, Coursera reached a deal with the richest man in the world, Carlos Slim, to offer its MOOCs in Spanish in Mexico. And you'll see some strategies like that. But all I want to suggest to you is that what looks like the best option is going to be an incredibly competitive space in which there are going to be some winners, but there's certainly going to be some losers as well. And then how is this going to be financed? Many institutions are partnering with for-profit companies like Pearson or Academic Partnerships. And the revenue division is 50-50. Wow. What a deal, right? You provide the intellectual property, and someone else takes 50% of your revenue. And the reason institutions do this is they don't have the money for the startup costs. And many institutions feel desperate, and they're willing to agree to almost anything to get into this sphere. The history of technology in education, we all know, has been a history of failure. That is, film strips, educational television. We can all run through the litany of various kinds of innovation which failed. And as a historian, I guess I should be saying, why should this time be different? At Columbia, they invested $30 million in something called Fathom, and they generated $700,000. Okay. You can lose an awful lot of money in this space amazingly quickly with no visible consequences. But while technology is no panacea, I can assure you it's going to be part of our solution, and this time will be different because it needs to be different. We need to put in place e-advising systems that help us identify at-risk students. We need to put in place intelligent tutors to help our students who are at risk. We need to be able to provide 24/7 support services to our students. We have to engage this new generation of learners with interactive simulations and educational games and real-world projects. We've got to adopt personalized adaptive learning because we've got to improve rates of student success. The article in the Chronicle of Higher Education this morning that talked about the shift away from faculty to support personnel was written as a kind of lament, a kind of cry from the heart that the old system of education is breaking down, but it's breaking down for a reason, right? Our courses are no longer simply the products of a lone artisan working in his or her study all by him or herself. The kinds of courses that will work in this new environment need to be collectively developed. They require educational technologists. They require instructional designers. They require assessment specialists. This isn't marginal. This is at the very core of the new enterprise. And so we are all pioneers on the digital frontier. All of us will make some mistakes along the way, but we have a huge responsibility on our shoulders, and we have to be successful. Thank you very much. If you have any questions or comments, I'll be delighted to hear them. There's microphones towards the middle. Otherwise, I wish you the very best. Oh, a question.
I do have a question. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So I'm with the Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, and we are looking at many of these issues and working with many institutions and associations. In your opinion, with such great transformation happening all throughout the institution, and who do you think that the institutions are going to turn to help them with their transformation efforts?
Well, we've turned to you. That is, I was just on the phone with Art Seavey yesterday. I think there are different roads that are possible, and I think some of those roads might be less desirable, but they're attractive on cost grounds. But above all, it's going to require partnerships of all kinds. What I'm hoping for are design partnerships, for example, with for-profits, where we work together as opposed to outsourcing what we're doing. The foundations are absolutely essential. They provide the imprimatur, the stamp of approval for new and innovative directions, as well as resources that are indispensable in all this. Also, the foundations provide a kind of free space where different systems and different institutions can work together, something that's very, very difficult otherwise. I am absolutely convinced that nobody can go down this road alone, that we have to work in collaboration with others who share our same interests.
I want to point out there's two studies out there that look at, by Kennedy Research, that look at consulting and other industries that are going through great transformation are spending $8 billion a year on change management and $9 billion a year on digital strategy. And when you look at the segments who are purchasing the consulting in those areas, they higher education, education doesn't even make other our public sector. So, you know, we're going to have to just... Institutions are going to have to look for new partners, not just foundations, but they have to look for new partners. Where do you think they're going to be? How do you see that shift? Are there going to be new types of consultants? Are we going to turn to some of the traditional consulting firms or boutique firms?
There are different kinds of consulting that institutions are going to need to do. For example, right now, many of the online programs that are developed do not have a business logic to them, and they are not sustainable. And so institutions are going to have to turn to market research companies to figure out what programs have demand and how that demand can best be met and pricing. And those kind of consultants, those kind of market research consultants, are going to be extraordinarily valuable. Mm-hmm. Business models and organizational consulting is going to be extremely important. But in terms of visioneering, I've been fairly disappointed in the kinds of visions that many of the traditional consulting companies have offered. Because what they do is they repeat back to you what you said to them and your own predictions. And they're not providing a real vision, a fresh vision, an outside-the-box vision of what the future could look like. And they can cost, one of the major consulting firms, I think, charges something about $500,000 a month, minimum 3 months. You better make a lot of revenue later to make that pay, and you better get input from them that's indispensable that you couldn't have gotten any other way.
Well, according to Harvard Business Review, that the consulting industry is being disrupted too, so yeah. That might be good news.
Thank you. Other questions?
Interesting vision. How does your vision energize the artisan to go through this change in such a short time?
How does it energize the artisan?
We are using, the faculty?
We're using a variety of incentives, but I want to reemphasize that I am less interested in incentivizing individual faculty members than departments and colleges. They then figure out how to do it internally. But I need to have projects that have institutional buy-in and that are part of an institution's strategic vision. I was one of those artisans who developed various things. I have a website called Digital History. It's used by, about 250,000 teachers and students a week, separate IP addresses. I would have done that on my own. I didn't need external support. I got some external support, but I would have done it on my own. Did it transform the institution? Not one bit. We have to transform institutions, and that requires really convincing the organizational units that it's in their interest.
Is this truly a top-down reorganization?
No, I'm hoping that there's a growing awareness that we have, as in higher ed, a mission, access, affordability, student success, and the like, and that it needs to be part of our DNA. That is, we all have a responsibility for that. The fact is, though, I don't need universal support to do what I want to do. I need some support. I need some really excited and enthusiastic people. But I don't need everybody. Let me give you an example. Foreign languages, the less commonly taught foreign languages, are in trouble in this country. And they are besieged. And so I've gone to the foreign language departments and said, if you will scale your teaching synchronously, not asynchronously, across my entire system, I can help you out. Because it isn't right that people in San Antonio can't take Arabic, or that people in Brownsville can't take German, right? And so if people want to play ball with me, I'll play ball with them. Because I think it works to everybody's benefit in the end. But if Armenian decides not to play, that's their choice, right? And I'm not going to worry. But for those who want to participate in this new endeavor, I think, you know, they can count me as an ally.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thanks so much.
I just have a couple of really quick announcements before you go. It'll take less than a minute, I promise. One really quick reminder to complete your evaluations. You can get them straight off your mobile device. We really appreciate the feedback. Remember, we have an online focus session coming up in April on faculty development, so mark your calendars. And finally, thank you for joining us here in New Orleans, and we will see you in Anaheim in February 2015. Thank you.